Hi, I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic. This looks like night court on a holiday weekend. I mean, this looks like this is good. Actually, it's a sting operation. There are policemen at the back with warrants. And if you have one with your name on it, they'll find you. You know, like, I'm really glad to be here. You know, I after you have a countdown and you see, like, Steve give the big book to Nicole and Spencer, it's like, that's really AA. That's the deal right there. If you don't understand that, then, you know, you're out there where the buses don't run. You know, like, it's, you know, because that's the whole deal. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come over and speak over here. I want to thank my buddy Corey for picking me up at the airport, and Craig and Mary Ann and Ed and Kari and all the folks that I had time to spend time with, Tracy, who I haven't seen for a while. And it's always great to be at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, particularly one like this. You folks look very sick. I mean, I want to tell you that. I watched you when he was giving directions to the seats. He was like, eh. You know, I'll tell you the truth. I called Bill Wilson and I said, Bill, you know, like, I don't know if they get it yet. You know, like, if this was a sinking craft, we'd have wet feet by now. You know, like, this is amazing. And I also enjoyed Pete sharing last night and the Al-Anon show this morning. I'd never seen the big book dance before, particularly in a two-piece bathing suit. You know, like, you know, more will be revealed. It's it's a good little thing here. And then the panel, the sponsorship panel was great. As it turned out, one of the women on it, Sarah, had been my host 15, 18 years ago over in Flagstaff. And, you know, it's a great thing to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I'm a real alcoholic. You know, that's how I got here, you know. I drank stuff that not only hit the spot, it removed it. You know, like, it was like, you know, it just took it away, you know. I was one of those guys that always asked embarrassing questions in bars, like, hey, is, you know, is my fly open? And they'd say, no. And I'd say, well, it should be. I'm peeing, you know, like, you know, like, you know. And that's just the way, you know, that's just the way it was. I would make statements to people I didn't know, like, I'm a lawyer. I said, are you impressed with that? And they'd say, no. I said, okay, I'm a doctor. You know, like, I could be pretty much whatever you needed me to be if we were going to be drinking together. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but there are certain things that let you know you're a real alcoholic. One of the great rights we have in this country is that when you're arrested, you have the right to remain silent. I never had the ability. You know, I always thought there was something else that had to be said. You know, like, that's just the way it is. My mom said, you know, my dad died when I was young, and my mom raised seven kids. And she used to say, you know, in my family, we're either in AA or you need it. You know, there's no middle ground. And my mom used to read beer cans, the ingredients in beer cans, and say, I don't know what they put in here. It makes you act so stupid. You know, like, you know, and that's just the way it was. I mean, I was one of those guys that I started going to the bar when I was about 13 years old. I lived in New York. My brother was a bartender. I'd go in. I'd sit in the back with the other guys and play cards. We played pinochle. And we'd just sit there and have a few beers, and I went home. And I didn't know I was in training. You know, and then sooner or later, I did that for a few years, and then I crossed over that invisible line. You know, I see things today that just don't make sense to me anymore in sobriety. There's an ad on TV. It says, you don't have enough bars. And it pertains to a telephone company. You know, I don't relate to that. I was coming down the steps at the airport, and it said Thunderbird. I said, all right. And then next to it said Global School of Business. I said, you know, like, it just doesn't make sense to me. They have things now you put on your head, a guy told me, and he says you can have an out-of-body experience. It's called virtual reality. I said, hell, that's old. You know, like, I used to do that with gin, you know, like, I mean, I could get so high on gin, I could hunt ducks with a rake, you know, like, it was, I was just like, whoa, yeah, you know. I always thought Gordon should come with a bail bondsman's number right on there, you know, like, that's the way it is. We have one of the best bail bondsmen in San Diego. His name is King Stallman. That's a great name for a bail bondsman. And he has a great ad. He comes on with a little crown, and he said, I'm the king. It's better to know me and not need me than to need me and not know me. You know, like, you know? Every time I see that ad, I go, yeah, that's why you're the king. You know, like, that's the deal. But I don't know about you guys, but I probably should have had a sponsor in kindergarten, you know? You know, I just didn't know what was going on, and I thought I did, you know? Like, I need someone to call and have them say, you know, Kenny, yeah, eat the cookies, take the nap, you know? Like, you know. I was that way right out of the gate, you know? I didn't see things the same. I didn't hear things the same. I mean, the first presidential election that I could vote in was when Kennedy was running in 60. And I was in a bar, it was a very uncommon occurrence. And a guy next to me said, Ken, who are you voting for? And I said, Jack Kennedy. And he said, well, I know why you're voting for him. I said, why? He said, because he's Irish Catholic. I said, no, asshole, I'm voting for him because I'm Irish Catholic. You know, like, that's, you know, that's just the way I used to filter information. You know, it came in one way, it came out another way, and that's just the way it was. And I was, as I said, I was really, my mom said I was born spring-loaded. You know, I was like, in high school, I was court-ordered to go to a psychiatrist because I had some anger issues. And hard to believe today, I'm such a calm, serene guy. But at that time, I used to have a low trigger mechanism. And so I went to this psychiatrist, and he said to me, what are you thinking right now? So I made something up, and he said, that's not what you're thinking. He said, what are you thinking right now? So I made something else up. Finally, he said, tell me what you're thinking. And at that exact moment, what I was really thinking is, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? And somehow I knew I didn't want to share that with him, you know, like, I hadn't even met you guys yet, but intuitively knew, don't tell him that, you know, like, you know. I was living with my mom in a senior citizen home right before I came to AA. My wife had moved out of state with my two kids to maintain some sanity. And I had been in my mom's senior citizen place so long I could use the walker. You know, I was getting real good there. And they sent her a letter and told her that, you know, I'd have to get out because I'm not a senior citizen. So I was in just a real bind, and people had always told me to try to go to AA, and I just didn't listen to them. And then finally, I went to AA. Now, and my sobriety date is July 5th of 1970. And my mom said, you know, that's so apropos for you because you did everything on a fifth. So I showed up at this meeting, and I was wearing a blue wool suit. I was in Brooklyn. I was wearing a blue wool suit. I had a shirt and tie on. And I had been in a barroom deal where some guy gave me a barroom facial. You know, my eye was a little knocked out. My lip was a little fat. And I had a little throat in my mouth. And somehow they knew I was a newcomer. And the guy said to me, oh, you know, what look just like you guys. He said, come on up front. That's where the miracle happens, you know. No. Oh, yeah, I want to be where the miracle happens, you know. So I went up front, sat through the meeting, and then afterward, the guy said to me, "We go over to the diner, you better come with us." And at that time, I didn't have too much on my calendar. So I went over to the diner with the boys, and they had a booth in there. I think it was an AA booth. I think they made it special for AA and put it in the diner. It was like an eight-person half-moon booth. And what they did was they said, "Hey, slide in there." Big mistake. You don't get to go home until everybody goes home, you know? Like, you're just like, big mistake. So I was in there with two plumbers, a priest, a lawyer, and an FBI agent. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is what it's come down to. You know, like, it's, you know, I'm finally scraping bottom now. You know, like, this guy's supposed to give me some kind of redemption, and here he is drunk, too. And the other guy was always chasing me. And, you know, and the plumber was there, and he said to me, "I'm going to be your temporary sponsor." Now, he died last year, so he was my temporary sponsor for 37 years, you know. Now, you had to see this guy to believe him. I had to take a lot of pictures later on in life because nobody would believe him. This guy had a head that looks like it had worn out two bodies. You know, like it was just, you know. And he did some fighting when he was younger, so he had this twitch, you know. And he smoked these cigars. I think he got a dozen of them for a nickel, you know, like that. And the smoke would be all over the place, and he'd say, "If you want what I have." And I wanted it. So he knew I was really in a jackpot. I had moved into a place, and it was like all drug addicts and stuff, and it was just not an uptown place. And he used to say, "Come on over for dinner," all the time. And when I went over, he had me locked in with his family, and I'd eat dinner there. And this was 1970, and they had just come out with the 9-passenger station wagons, and the back seat faced out the back. And Fast Eddie and I always had to sit facing out the back in the back seat. And I used to say to him things like, "How come Fast Eddie and I always have to sit facing out the back?" And he'd look at me and say, "Well, I want you to see the wreckage of your past, you know?" So we were doing the meeting thing, and I was going over there for dinner, and I was like really getting in there. I had a couple of weeks under my belt, and one night, you know, we'd been doing this for about a month and a half, sitting in the back seat, and one night he gets a phone call, and he comes to the dinner table, and he said, "We just got a 12-step call." He said, "You and me got to go on it." I said, "Good, good, good." I had no idea what a 12-step call was. But I could tell he was happy about it. You know, his head was almost coming off his shoulders, you know, like, "Let's go, Ken, we gotta go." So we get out to the car, I head for the back, and he said, "Hey, sit up front." I said, "Yeah, this thing's starting to work now, yeah." Now I can see what we're gonna hit, you know, like, So we get in the car, we go off, and we get to this brownstone in Brooklyn, and it was a typical brownstone on a typical street. There's no parking. There was no parking at all. So he pulls up there, and he says to me, and I must say, you know, in fairness to him, I had been with him so long now, I was twitching. You know, I had a little twitch to me. So I wasn't smoking, but I was starting to get the twitch down pretty good. So he said to me, he said, "Can you go get this guy?" And I said, "Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm alcoholic, but I'm not retarded. You know, like, You know, I can go ring the bell and, you know, get the guy. So he took a puff on one of those nickel cigars, and he said to me, "This is serious. Can you get him?" I said, "You bet." You know. So I get out of the car, and I head up there, and he rides around the block. And as he tells the story, when he comes back, I have the guy on the ground, and I'm beating him with a garbage can lid. Sometime between the guy making this call and us getting there, he had what was called a second thought. You know? Which I have since found out he was entitled to, you know. But this was the first job they've ever given me in AA, you know. I wanted to get off to a good start, you know. Now, I'm not saying, I don't want to make it sound like it was cruelty or anything, you know. I hit him maybe 3, 4, 5 times tops, you know. And after the second one, there was no doubt in my mind, this guy was willing to turn his will and his life over to me, you know. So my sponsor whistles me back in the car like I'm a canine, and I go running over there. I get in the car, and we start down the avenue, and he's over there. I know he's not happy now. His head is like, I thought he might as well be sitting in the back seat, you know, like. And he was smoking. There was smoke all over the car, you know, like, and I mean, I thought any minute Indians would come, you know, like, I'm thinking, what the? So he looks over at me in the best manner he could, and he said, "I want you to do me 2 favors." I said, "Sure, sure, sure. What are they?" He said, "First, don't ever consider that a 12-step call." And he said, "Second," he said, "don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor for a while." You know? But, you know, Steve gave the 2 newcomers tonight the big book, which I always like to refer to as the owner's manual. And when I got sober, I got an owner's manual. I never had an owner's manual before. I mean, for the first time in my life, I now had a reference that I could go to and see something. And I don't know about you guys, but I got through school totally unscarred by education, you know? You know, I hung out with guys that, you know, you say, "There's a dead bird," they look up, you know, like The teacher said to my buddy Vinny, she says, "How do you spell Mississippi?" And Vinny said, "You mean the river or the state?" You know, like that's a, you know. These guys thought Moby Dick was a venereal disease. You know, they just didn't know. They just had no clue. So I started going to meetings and hanging out with the guys that were like me. And the one thing I noticed is that those guys were staying sober. And they weren't intellectual giants, but they had zeroed in on, and they were made to be aware of by the old-timers, that if you wanted to stay here, there's a magnet that will keep you here. And that magnet is willing to grow spiritually and doing service work. If you're willing to do those 2 things, you don't have to be Einstein to get sober, you know. You can live out where the buses don't run, you know. It doesn't matter because you can get sober. So he took me through the steps just the way they were in the big book. We didn't do any ancillary paperwork. I didn't go to seminars. I didn't do any of this nonsense. I just took the steps right out of the big book the way it was suggested. And I did it with my sponsor. And as we went through those steps, what happened to me was I was evicted from my hiding places. All of my life, I had hiding places. And as we hit each step, I was evicted from those hiding spots. And what happened was I began to have a sense of what was going on. When I was in school, teachers, to get rid of me, would send me to study hall or to the library. And I didn't mind that because I was an avid reader. I enjoyed reading. I just didn't want all the other nonsense going on, you know. And so I loved to read. And I loved to look at words. And the word in the big book, spiritual, got my attention. And I focused in on it. And what I came to realize is that inside that word spiritual is the word ritual, R-I-T-U-A-L. And if you want to be spiritual, you have to develop a ritual. And doing the steps and doing the service work and all the stuff that Pete talked about last night, that's how you get into the ritual. People think that somehow this is like a real ethereal thing out there somehow. That's not the way it is. It's an inside job. You know, God knows what he's working with, you know. I mean, let's, you know. And after a while, you begin to wonder, like, how can there be any discord in the world at all? Because Christians believe in one God. Muslims believe in one God. Jews believe in one God. We were all sent out from the same home office. The same guy, you know? And you wonder, how the heck did all the nonsense start? And it started because what happened was we developed egos where we thought we knew something we didn't know. I mean, I love working with newcomers today. You know, they're going to seminars to try to escape from a reality they're not in. You know? They're trying to solve problems they don't have, you know? And sometimes when they get on these problems and you hear the same person talk about the same thing at every meeting over and over and over again, it's like somebody watching somebody milk a mouse. You know? A lot of activity, but very little milk, you know, like a... And somehow people get caught up in the idea that this is about what I feel. This is about what I think. This is about what I believe. No, it's not. I'll be honest with you. I don't care what you feel. I don't care what you believe. I don't care what you think. And you shouldn't care about me in any of those areas. This is about the actions we take and the actions we don't take. Simple as that. You know, it's just that simple. It's about the actions we take. I never got punched out in a bar because I was standing next to someone feeling like, well, I shouldn't be standing next to this person. I usually said something about their ancestry or something, or their mother-father relationship or something, you know, like, and the next thing you know, there would be stuff happening, you know? That's why the big book says when the alcoholic drinks, something happens, you know, like, and if you're an alcoholic, you don't have to know what it is definitively, you just know it's going to happen, you know? It's like I used to walk into a bar and in the back of my mind it would be like a drum roll and I could hear them all saying, let the games commence, you know, like he's, yeah, let's get going, you know? And I know God has a great sense of humor. I mean, God gave women their sexual peak at 42, men at 18. And he said, work with it, work with it. And I know God has a great sense of humor by the games, the weapons of mass destruction that he allowed us as alcoholics to find in the bars. I mean, just look at the weapons of mass destruction that exist in the bar. Back east, we played shuffleboard. A long piece of wood with heavy metal and two drunks at each end. Yeah, this is a good game, yeah. And then if that didn't work for you, they had pool, sticks, heavy balls. Fun, you know. Now, I personally didn't like shuffleboard, and I personally didn't like pool. My favorite was darts. as the night went on, you'd throw them out there and wonder where they went, you know? You know? And they were light, so you could do it all night, you know? And I remember being in a bar with my brother, and there was a little break front in front of the men's bathroom there, and a guy was heading to the bathroom, and I had my dart, and I threw it. And it stuck in his leg. And he went into the bathroom. And my brother looked at me and said, "We need the dart." So I went in while he was standing there, and I just said, "Excuse me," and pulled it out of his leg. And he didn't know it was there. He said, "Thanks," you know. But you know, this is what we did, you know. I mean, to show you where I was at, I got sober in July of 70, and Bill Wilson died in January of 71. And Bill died on January the 24th. And in New York, they broke his anonymity in all the papers, and it said, you know, co-founder of AA dies. And, you know, to show you the mental process that I had at the time, I called my sponsor, and I said, "Wow, this is something, huh?" He said, "What?" I said, "The owner died." I said, "It would look like it might work, and now they'll probably close it down, you know?" And he said, "No, Sparky. They're going to try to keep the meetings open for a while, you know? Like, you just keep coming along, you know?" So that's what I did. I kept going along. And as a result of taking the steps myself and doing those things that were suggested, what happened was I got to grow in ways I never knew. I got an appreciation of life I just never understood. I had a sense of peace which I never had before. You know, the one thing that psychiatrist said to me that really was very important, I didn't understand it totally at the time, but I did later on. And what he said was, what's true in your mind is true in its consequence, even if it isn't true. And you can live a whole life thinking something to be the truth when in fact it isn't. And it could cause you a lot of harm. You know, it could cause you a lot of grief. But it's not the truth. That's why we say there's relative truth, and then there's ultimate truth. Alcoholics have a lot of relative truth. We just think we know stuff, you know. Like the guys I hang out with, I heard a guy in a conversation about 3 months ago, and he was talking to another guy, and he said, "You know, Nikki, if your mother didn't have any children, there's a good chance you won't." You know? And these guys are sober, you know. You know? I look at them sometime and I think to myself, the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still turning, you know? Like, you know? You know? And the bottom line is you get to see people stay sober that you wouldn't think would stay sober. And as for this relative truth and ultimate truth, you know, most people talk about sunrise and sunset, sunrise and sunset. And then when the astronauts went out into space, one of the truths that they came back with is the sun doesn't rise and it doesn't set. The sun is always just doing what it's doing. It's where we are on the Earth that determines we see sunrise and sunset. But the sun isn't rising and setting. And so that's the ultimate truth. Yet the relative truth is every day we think we see a sunrise and a sunset. And we just say, hey, that's the way it is. And we were talking for a little bit at dinner time, the day Bill Wilson was in that lobby in the Mayflower Hotel, and the big deal of his life had fallen through, and he had no idea how he was going to pay his bill. He had no idea how he was going to get home. He had no idea what he was going to do after he got home because he had no income. And then he stood there and he thought he might even drink. I'm sure that night he didn't journal down, "Hey, really good day, you know. I got to meet a doctor, Dr. Bob, you know." I'm sure that wasn't in his journal. His journal was probably like, "What the heck happened? You know, what the heck happened?" And when you knew, tonight I noticed during the countdown, there's at least 100 of you here who have less than a year. There might even be more than that, but at least 100. And I'm going to tell you something. I hope you totally understand it. And that is, over the next year, you're going to think that we're laughing at you. And you're going to be absolutely right. You know? And what I want you to know so that you understand it is we're not laughing at your problems. We're laughing at your solutions. You know? You're going to find... I got to take this baby off. You're going to find the word more in a lot of your solutions. If I only had more. And that's not going to be the deal. And you're always going to have these big why questions like, why? And if you read that big book, you don't see, we don't read why it works. We read how it works, you know? You know, armadillos have been on the planet for many, many years, and people have studied them diligently for over 100 years. And what I know about armadillos, and I'll share with you because I think it's very important that you know, is that when armadillos give birth, they always give birth to four armadillos. They don't give birth to one, they don't give birth to two, three, always four. And the four that they have are always the same sex. They're always all males or all females. And the deal is, people are studying them, and they're going, why? And sooner or later, you figure some alcoholic should say, hey, that's the way it is. You know, like, hey, what are you going to do? Load the dice so they have three? You know, like... You know, two, what are you going to do? And the deal is that you just don't know. You know, there are some things we're not meant to know. They're just, that's the way it is. And when life happens to you, that's the way it is. I mean, I watch people that, do you ever work with a newcomer and have them have trouble with the third step? And they'll say things like, Ken, I can't turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Why is that, Sparky? Well, I don't believe in God, or I don't think God can do this for me. Well, let me ask you a question. Who do you think is running your life now? Did you not take a first step where you said that you were alcoholic and that your life was unmanageable? You know? And did you not read in How It Works, or hear read in How It Works, one of the most important lines in the big book, and that is, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And if God has all the power, what do you think you're playing with, Sparky? What part of all is causing you problems? Is it the or the L? You know, like, Hey, you know? The deal is that God has all the power. And if you take the third step just the way it is in the big book, what you realize after you're done taking it is you haven't given up anything. You're arguing about giving up something you don't have. That's a tricky mental process. That's almost like a Kennedy vote. You know, like it's like you say, Wesken, what are you giving up? Well, you know. And then the other kind of guy, the guy who reads the big book, will come back and say, if I continually give up my power to God, I'm going to be like the hole in the donut. You are the hole in the donut. Yeah. And thank God you are, because donuts come and go. But the hole is always there. You know? And it's that hole that connects you that to whatever this infinite is. You know, when Bill was in Towns Hospital and things were not going great for him and he didn't know what was going on and Ebby came to visit him, one of the books that Ebby brought him, in fact the only book, was William James, Varieties of Religious Experience. And the reason he brought it to him is because it had already been decided by Carl Jung and all these other people who were involved in looking at our lives as alcoholics, saying the only way you're going to get out of this thing is you have to have a complete psychic change. And that psychic change is that, you know, that's the only thing that's going to help you. The book, the literature is real clear. No human power could have relieved my alcoholism, but God couldn't would if he saw it. So, you know, like, if you're counting on a sponsor to get you through this, you know, they can point to the principles. Try not to bite their finger, too, but, you know, they can point, but, you know, you have to get there. It's your deal. And the thing is that when it, that sentence that says God has all the power, may you find him now, the book also said, and this morning they were talking about it on the panel, the spiritual malady. Pete mentioned it last night. The spiritual malady. You know, once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I never knew for me what that spiritual malady was until about 12, 15 years ago. And then it became really clear to me what that malady was. The malady I was suffering from was I was never content in the moment I was in. I was always looking back on past events and evaluating how I could have done them differently or better or improved on them or whatever. Or I was looking ahead to phantom stuff that may never happen and be working on that. And the end result is by doing that and keeping my crafty little head in action, I was missing out on this now. And this is where God is. So I was operating without God. I was operating in a realm where obviously I'm going to feel the hole in my chest and the feeling of separation. And that's simply because I'm trying to be where God isn't. And that's not a good place to live. And if you look at the word now, N-O-W, and spell it backwards, it's one, W-O-N. When you've learned to live in the now, you've won. And I don't want to ruin your day or your night, but it's the only place we can live. Now is the only time there is. What about there and then? Well, when you get to there and then, it's here and now. You know, it's a, you know, you're going to get this eventually. You know, there's a beat to this. You know, and the beat is that no matter what you think you're doing, you're always going to be physically in the now, breathing in this moment, and this is the only place you can take an action. And if your mind is preoccupied with trying to solve stuff out here that never happened, that will probably never happen, and stuff back there, you're going to spend a lot of time away from God. And what you're going to find out is as you move closer to God, the problems of this world will get smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually they disappear. And what will happen is the great compensation for moving in the spiritual direction is that you'll lose fear. Fear will start to go away from you. It tells you it very clearly in my book anyway, in my literature, it says, as you become conscious of God's presence, you'll lose your fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. You'll be reborn. You'll be reborn in this moment. And you know, if you're not in this moment, you know, you miss out. Life is a joke, and we're the punchline, you know? You know, God sent us out because he didn't have Lincoln Logs. You know, like, it's like, you know, let's go down there and see what these guys can do. And we've done it, you know? And the deal is that in growing along spiritual lines, what you get to do is you get to take every day and have some fun with it. And don't get caught up in all the nonsense of people, you know, well, I'm afraid of this, I'm afraid of that. If you really want to be afraid, if you want to be afraid, I'll tell you what you should fear. You should fear going to bed. 98% of the people who die in this country die laying down. And you have people say, I can't wait to get home, go to bed. I'm afraid of everything, but I can't wait to get to bed. You know? And the deal is that you should be afraid of there because that's where they die. They die laying down. You know, when you get in at night and you say, good night, it could be good night. You know, like it. So if that, and then when you sleep, if you're 60 years old, if you're 60 years old and you sleep 8 hours a day, by the time you're 60, you would have slept 20 years. And some power took care of you while you were asleep. The power you don't believe in. I don't believe in it. Yeah, just worry. It's taken care of you. Don't worry about it. You know, you probably don't believe in gravity, but wait till you fall. You know, we'll watch you go up. You know. So that's the deal. You know, it gets so simple here, and yet I go to meetings sometimes and I hear people that want to make it so complex. And what will happen to you is that as you grow spiritually, you'll just become more and more comfortable with life. And you'll find out that whatever experience you're supposed to be having is the one you're having. You know? Guy said, "What's temptation, Ken?" I said, "Temptation is God letting you know the areas you need to work on." You know? this is not heavy stuff, you know? I have a t-shirt at home, and a lot of guys wear it. It says, "Leap before you look." You know? Instead of sitting around thinking, you know? Three words you never want to hear an alcoholic say is, "I've been thinking," you know? Ooh. It scares most people, you know? And the ideas that they have, you know, if you're really an alcoholic, you know, you go to a wedding, you want to be the bride. You go to a funeral, you want to be the corpse. And then you say, "But I want to be humble. I really don't want too much attention. I just want all of it," you know? And that's just the way it is. And we don't live in the moment. You know, we're just not in the moment. It's like the guy who was in Vegas and he met this beautiful woman and he said he'd like to spend the night with her. And she said, "No way." And he said, "I'll give you $10,000. So within moments, they're upstairs, they're on a bed, and she says, "Kiss me on the lips." And he does. And he says, "Oh, I don't know." And she says, "Well, kiss me on the shoulder." And he does. He says, "Oh, I don't know." And she looks at him and she said, "What don't you know?" He said, "I don't know where I'm going to get the 10 grand. You know, like, see? That is definitely alcoholic thinking, you know. You're right in the middle of a good thing and you're projecting the problem. You know, there is no problem. You know, 99% of what you worry about is never going to happen. And the other 1% will happen so fast you won't have time to get ready, you know. And what you'll find out as you go along is that as you get more and more comfortable with this, you'll relate to everything. I used to have a terrible fear of dogs. A terrible fear. I've been bitten more than once. It seemed like they were always trying to keep me out of places I was trying to get into. And so I've been bitten, and I have a real fear of dogs. But that fear has just gone away. Several months back, I was riding down the street in San Diego, and I looked in my rearview mirror, and a Rottweiler was chasing after me. I don't know if you know what a Rottweiler is, but it's like a Doberman on steroids. You know, like it's this huge, huge dog. And so I pulled over, and this Rottweiler pulled right up alongside of me, and I pushed the window, and it went down, and he looked at me, and he was, and I looked at him. And just for that moment, that dog and me were on the same wavelength. That dog knew that I had chased after a lot of shit in my life, having no idea what I was going to do when I caught it. And he knew he was in the same place, you know? And that's the way life is. It's getting in touch with everything and realizing that life is just the way it is. God does a lot of bank shots just to show off. You think you're going in this direction, and somehow he misfires you and has you go in another direction. No, it's just the way it is. And he does that because he knows that we as human beings are spiritual in nature. And if we aren't feeding our spiritual side, it doesn't matter what happens to our physical side. It just doesn't matter. I mean, we are like an invention that has no purpose until we meet the inventor. And then when we meet the inventor, the purpose is revealed to us. You know, and don't think you're unique. You know, and people say, "Well, I can't be happy because this happened to me and it shouldn't have happened to me, or this didn't happen to me and it should have happened to me." There isn't a person in this room who doesn't have one of those episodes or more. You know, something that happened to you that shouldn't have happened to you, but it did. And something that should have happened to you that didn't, and it should have. And that's called life. You know, that's just called life. And if you spend all your time with that, you know, you're missing out on your chances to be of service to other people. The one thing we never lose the capacity to do is to be of service. We never lose that capacity. You don't have to have anything to be abundant. You can be abundant with nothing. I know guys that had, in the material world, little or nothing. We used to have a guy, Lewis, come to our meetings on Saturday at the Grove. And Lewis lived in a little Streamview trailer. And he was 38 years sober, and he got sober when he was 50. He was 88 years old. And Lewis had this great insight into life that was so simple. He was definitely one of my heroes. And if you were sharing and he didn't like what you were saying, he'd start reading the Reader's Digest. And he would put his hand in there where the word vocabulary was, and he'd look at the word, and then he'd turn to the back and see what it meant. And of course, newcomers who would have 6, 8, 10 years would come over to him and say, "Lewis, that's not the way that works." And Lewis would act very surprised, like, "Oh, how does it work?" And then the newcomer would explain it to him. He'd say, "There are four options there, A, B, C, and D. You're supposed to look at the word and then pick the one you think is the right answer. And when you're all done guessing, you go to the back and see how you did." And Lewis would just look at him and say, "Why would I guess if I know where the answer is?" You know? And that's the way it is in the big book. You folks who have less than a year, you're going to hear a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff. A lot of suggestions. Most of it's going to be good. But what I would suggest to you is, if you want to get off to a good start, and that's what I think most of you want to do, is whenever anyone says anything to you about a suggestion, ask them, say, "Look, I'm new at this and I want to get off to a good start. Could you please show me in the big book where you got that?" You know? Thank you. Of course, you don't want to see people getting hurt on good suggestions. And I'm not saying the suggestions are all bad, but, you know, some of them, like, "No sex in the first year." I just gave up the most important thing in my life. Now you want to give me number two? You know, like, you know? In my book, it says things like, "More will be revealed." You know, like, I never saw that in the big book. Never. And yet you have people saying that, you know, that causes them problems. There's things that people mean well by, but they're just not in the big book. They're not part of AA. And as long as you couch them in that, saying, "You know what, this isn't in the big book, but I found this to be successful," fine. But you don't want to take somebody who's counting on you and send them off in the wrong direction. You know, you just don't want to do that, because you'd have to answer for that at some point. They'll have to answer for it at some point, but you'll have to answer for it at some point too. And the deal is, if you don't know what you're doing, you're in the right place. You know? I hear people say, "Well, I'm afraid of doing this because I may make a mistake." Watch the news. You know? You think you could change something, make a bigger mistake than we see every day on the news? You know, don't worry about it. We're counting on you. You know, we want you to make mistakes. We need the laughs. You know, like, and just remember that this is all about living in the moment. This is living in this now. You know, God, as I said, God has a great sense of humor. And I think what he did was, when he sent us out, he made us a joke. And if we understand the joke, that's good. But if we don't understand the joke, that's not so good. And the deal is that, you know, you just go through life sometimes and you say to yourself, what's important and what isn't important? And I can tell you, what's important is laughter. Laughter is very important. Laughter does a lot of good things for you. And that's why I love to come to these things and hear people laugh, because I know a couple of things about laughter that most people don't know. Number one is, you cannot laugh and think at the same time. It's impossible. So every time you're laughing, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you, you know? So it's real critical to keep laughing, you know? And the other thing is while you're laughing, your body produces these things called endorphins. And endorphins build up your immune system. They make you very, very healthy. You know, in fact, the Journal of American Medicine says that next to sex, laughter produces the most endorphins. Now, I'm alcoholic. So what comes into my mind is, if you can laugh and have sex at the same time, those babies will be a pumping. You know, they'll be just going wild, you know. And it could start tonight. I know you have a 13-step dance, you know, like so, you know. So what I would do is start to scan the room, you know, look for targets of opportunity. So, you know, you don't have to find Miss Wright, just Miss Wright now, you know, like, or maybe even Miss Perhaps, you know, like, you know. And hopefully they'll play the same music that you're used to when you were out there doing what you did, you know, like, I'm just 2 6-packs away from loving you, you know, like, I don't, you know. Throw a saddle on the stove, Mama. We're riding a range tonight. You know, like that. And now they have this new one out by the Cherry Bombs. I don't know if you heard it. It says, hard to kiss those lips at night that chew my ass out all day long. You know, like, you know. You know? You guys just got about a 2-minute respite from yourself. You know, like, yeah. If there were a song for AA, it would be, I am always on my mind, I am always on my mind, you know. And the deal is that here, just by doing the very simple things that are suggested in the 12 steps, the very simple things, life takes on new meaning. Will things happen, as I said? Yeah. You know, several years back, I had a son who came home to me, and he was in full-blown AIDS. And he stayed with me for about 3 months, and then he died. And during that time, I got to see him go through stuff that I wouldn't wish on anybody. And again, I knew God had a good sense of humor because my ex-wife started coming to my house. I even got to meet my husband-in-law, you know, like. So there's always the reality of things going on, you know. And one of the things my son did was he went from being about 190 pounds down to about 120 pounds. And he was so weak, he could barely walk. And in order to maintain his dignity, he wanted to use the bathroom. So I would put comforters and pillows on the floor and then sit there and watch my son crawl to the bathroom. And sometimes he just couldn't do it all in one swoop, so he'd take a little nap and then head on out again. And one day as I was watching him go through this process, I couldn't help but think, my son is crawling on the floor to maintain his dignity. And I crawled on the floor and I lost my dignity. So crawling on the floor isn't the deal. It's what got you there. And that's the way it is in life. You know, in life, sometimes it just comes at you. My oldest son is going to be 50 in a couple of months, and he's not doing good. He suddenly has just gone in another direction, and he's not doing good. And you wonder why somebody would have so much knowledge about something and not understand it. But the book has that great line in there, surely this must be the answer, self-knowledge. But then the next sentence says, but it is not. It is not. You know, I had a sister die of cirrhosis in 85. She went in the hospital at 54, hemorrhaged for 3 months and died. And she died Christmas Day and we buried her. That year Christmas was on a Wednesday. We wakened her 2 days and we buried her Saturday. And the following week was New Year's Day and my brother died. And so we were in the same funeral home a week later and we had just buried my sister from it. Now we were burying my brother from it. And that night, my nephew got picked up for drunk driving. He had seen his aunt and his dad. And we're just slow learners. So our job, and I think you guys got the message here real clear this weekend from all of that I could see. I was really impressed with everything that went on here. But the thing is that we have a very important job here, and that is, you know, we have to be really, really good to one another and take care of one another, because we're only on loan. You know, we're only here for a short time. And our job is really just making sure that we make ourselves available to people when they need help. And, you know, there's a chapter in the big book. I'm always amazed when people say the book isn't definitive enough. You know, people say, well, you know, Ken, I wish it was clearer. And, you know, and you look at him, you say, okay, Sparky, you know, like, you know, how clear do you want it? I mean, there's lines in there like, you know, when we retire at night. Boy, that's confusing. Boy, I mean, that's, you know, that would throw anybody a curve. So when do you think that might be? Like when you're getting into bed and, you know, you're going to sleep maybe, huh? And it says we consciously review the day, you know, and we do it in a positive way. We review the day in a positive way, not a negative way, positive, you know. And then it has more very confusing instructions like, upon awakening. Like maybe you hear a bird or an alarm or something and your eyes open, hey, this must be upon awakening, you know, like, you know. And then it gets more confusing. It's during the day, we pause when agitated. Not if agitated, when agitated, you know. And the deal is the instructions aren't that hard. It's our perception, our perception. You know, William James, if you ever read that book, Variety of Religious Experience, the theme of that book is very, very important. And the theme of that book is, if you are going to live in this life happy, joyous, and free, you're going to have to become aware of the fact that there's an unseen world, that the closer you get to it, the happier you are. And the more distance you try to keep away from it, the greater you live in pain and fear. And that's just the way it is. And the theme of that book is that as you move closer and closer to that reality, which is God, God is the ultimate reality. You know, it says in the 12 and 12, you know, we'll have glimpses of his ultimate reality, God's kingdom. And all we have to do is do some basic stuff. It's not complicated. You know, do something. If it doesn't work, stop immediately. You know? If it does, keep going. You know, this is not that complicated. I am always amazed at how complicated people want to make it. You know, it's like watching somebody fall from a horse. And right before they're free of the horse, they reach up and they grab where you put your feet. What do you call that? The stirrup. Thank you. They grab the stirrup. And they're being pulled around the parking lot, hitting every speed bump. And those of us who love them and care for them are yelling, let go. Let go, you know. And they're saying, who, me? You know, yeah. And instead of letting go, they sign up for seminars on how to enjoy the ride. You know, like it's a, you know, like a. And you just say, you know, if you just let go, things would be so much easier. You know, just so much easier. I know you guys are getting antsy, and I know it's warm in here because I can tell you that. But I just want to say a couple of quick things and then I'll be done. I'll be done in the next few minutes. But in my life, I have been exposed to a lot of things. Some of them I judge good, some of them I judge bad. And all I can tell you is that a lot of the stuff I judge good turned out to be bad. And a lot of the stuff I judge bad turned out to be good. You know, when you come to AA, if you go to enough meetings, you're going to hear this 100 times during the first year, you newcomers. You're going to hear people say, when I got here, I lost everything. You notice we don't lose something. We lose everything, you know. You can tell good alcoholics by the number of times they use the word used to. You know, I used to live there. I used to be married to her, you know. I used to work here, you know. I used to have two of those, you know. And the deal is, that that's just the way we think, you know. And when you get here, you lose everything. And I said the same thing. Trust me, I said the same thing. I was no different. I've played most of the roles that most of the people I sponsor play. And the deal is, and I can tell you real fast, is that when I got here and I would say I lost everything, I've been here now long enough to know that the everything I lost has turned out to be nothing. And the nothing I was left with has turned out to be everything. Everything. You know, I live a life today that is just in the moment. My son ended up in hospice, and we stopped the medication, and the last day of his life, he opened his eyes, and he said, "Dad, where am I and what's going on?" And I had to tell him where he was and what was happening. And his head rolled to one side of the pillow, and he was in this world. And when he rolled back, he was of this world. And he winked at me, and he said, "I'm good to go, Dad. I'm good to go. I'm okay with this." And I had one hand and his mom had the other hand. And when we left there, I walked her down to the little chapel they had. And I said, "When we leave here today, I don't know what's going to be with you, but I want you to know that I've made amends to you before, but I would never, never want to leave here owing any amends to you. If I do, tell me. Because when I walk out that door, I'm going to live every day of my life being good to go." And that's something you can't buy. There's no price ticket on it. And I get to do that every day. I get to come here and see Steve, and I get to see Tracy, and I get to meet Craig and Marion, and just meet a lot of people that are new to me and old friends too. And the bottom line is that we're all in this together. A guy that Steve used to sponsor, a Persian fella, just came back from Iran. And there are now 240,000 members of AA in Iran. People who, by the nature of their religion, men and women cannot pray next to each other in the mosque. They have to be separated. But they go to AA meetings in the mosque together. So this is a powerful, powerful thing you belong to. Thank God we got some adult leadership here. So this is a very, very powerful thing. And don't lose track of your role here, because your role is powerful too. You're supposed to get on an oar and just start rowing. And please don't go topside. Because every time somebody goes topside and tries to take control of the craft, we hit a lot of stuff. You know, just stay on your oar and keep rowing. And what will happen is you will attract people to you. People will just want to be with you. You know, my mom raised us kids, and she did the best job she could with a very limited education and a lot of problems to deal with. And she used to tell this story about Johnny, and I'll close with that. And Johnny was a little kid who went to a Catholic school, and if you go to a Catholic school, there's a church there. And he had a very simple spiritual program. He used to run in the church in the morning and say, "Good morning, God. This is Johnny. I just want to tell you I'm here." And then he'd get out. And he'd do that after school and weekends and holidays and over the summer. And she said he contracted polio. And he was in this room and he was dying. And she said he was surrounded by his school chums and friends. And when it was very quiet, a voice was heard to say, "Hello, Johnny. This is God. I just want to tell you, I'm here." And that's the whole secret of being in AA. God is ever present, every day with you. If you think he's not there, you're mistaken. It's like a light plugged into the socket. You know, the power is there. Our job is to turn the light on. Take real good care of one another, because, as I said, we're only on loan. God bless you.